So this morning I'd like to talk about the last two times I talk, I've been talking about stories from the Gateless Gate, teachings of Chinese Zen teachers from the Gateless Gate. Today I'm going to talk about case five in the Gateless Gate, and this is one I haven't talked about before. I don't think I've talked about it before. So, the teacher's name is Shanyan. Not too well known a Zen teacher either. Not too well known in Chan Buddhism, which is the Chinese word for Zen. So, Shanyan said, well, I'm going to go sentence by sentence through it, and it's actually in your program. I'm going to go sentence by sentence through it, through what he said, and then through what the commentator Woman said, who is a commentator on all of these. So, Shanyan said to his monks, "I guess you guys are my monks." whatever. He said to his monks. It is like a person up a tree who hangs from a branch by their mouth. Their hands can't grasp a bough. Their feet can't touch the tree. So most of us can identify with the situation. A lot of times in our lives, we feel like we're just hanging from a branch, hanging from a cliff, hanging by our mouths, hanging by our whatever, with nothing to support us. I mean, we feel that way. We feel that way. When we feel that way, we're confused, we suffer, we go back and forth, should I be doing this, should I be doing that? And the more we suffer. We suffer. It gets dark. It gets dark in that tree. In that tree, we don't feel like we've loved enough or like we have anybody who really loves us, really gets us. And that we don't really connect with other people or whomever. So a lot of life is like that for a human being. And as we do our Zen meditation practice, that stuff comes in more. Sometimes it doesn't come in, but inevitably that comes in more, because as we do our meditation, our awareness broadens, and we're not just stuffing stuff down and keeping it out. So get in touch with our anguish. We get in touch with our insecurity. We get in touch with our frustration that we can't really accomplish what we want or be who we want to, manifest the stillness that supposedly is at the center of all being. Can't even touch it, much less manifest it. So that we suffer, and as we sit more and more, and we get our Zen practice going more and more, we notice that we're hanging, that we're just hanging. We're just hanging in life. We want something, we can't reach it, we can't get it. We get it for a minute, and then that branch goes, then another branch. And that's our life. It's a human situation. Stuck and hanging from a cliff or a branch or a tree. So those of you who are new to Zen meditation, I hope this isn't your first time here, because this may be your last time. But this will happen. If you really do a meditation practice, this happens. If it doesn't happen, you're not really doing a meditation practice, because meditation is opening up to the whole psyche without judging, without labeling, without running, without stuffing. And so that's why in Zen meditation we need friends. We need supporters. We need people to support us. We need friends. A teacher or some other friend. Just one or two friends. We only need one friend, really. One friend to really support us, to really get us, really understand what it's like for us to be hanging there. And just sitting facing this stupid wall day after day, which is our practice. That's our core practice. Well, you can choose your wall. Take any wall you want. I don't care. But that's our practice. From the beginning is end. That's what we've been doing. You need a friend to help you. You need a friend to support you. Just hanging there. And hopefully your friend will give you good advice, good support. Won't just say, oh, why are you doing this stupid shit anyway? Come on in. Come on in and watch it. You know, drink a beer or watch some TV or whatever. Or go to my church where we don't do this stupid shit. Excuse me. Excuse me. My profanity. I have been chided, so I will not say that again. And of course, we do. Support helps us. Support helps us from others. It helps us a lot. If the others are sympathetic, if they get what we're trying to do, especially if they've done it themselves, it helps us. But it doesn't help us as much as we want it to, because we're still there. We're still there in the branch. Hanging from the branch by our mouth. We're still there. So we come back, and we just notice with our kind attention what's happening, what the suffering entails, what's going on, what the worry, the stress is, without labeling, without making anything out of it. Don't make anything out of it. Just be with it. And that's the beginning of transformation. Usually, awareness doesn't get in. And lots of people live their whole lives with no, what I call, bare awareness or bare attention. No. They can run from one project to another and then veg out in front of the TV. Thank God it's Friday. Thank God it's Saturday. Thank God it's Sunday. Thank you. Meaning the next relief until I'm stressed out again. So, and we get sort of addicted to being unhappy. We get addicted to being unhappy. We get addicted to our talking to ourselves and all the fuss it creates. We can't imagine there's another way. But there is another way. But there isn't anything to it. It's just bare awareness. It's just bare attention to this breath, to this cushion, to this being here, this no being here. And it takes practice. So that's Shanyan's first line. It is like a person up a tree who hangs from a branch by their mouth. Their hands can't grasp a bough. Their feet can't touch the tree. Now the rest of his profound statement. Someone else comes underneath the tree and asks the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the west. If the person does not answer, they do not meet the questioner's need. If they answer, they lose their life. At such a time, how should they answer? How should they answer? So, so this question is about Bodhidharma is coming to the West. It's a symbol of the question about what's life? What is it? What is all this suffering? What is this? What is it? What's going on here? Is there something deeper? What is it? What is it? And Shangyan's challenge is not to evade our responsibility, even if we don't understand. Even if we don't understand. Our responsibility just to be here with him. In non-judgmental openness. Which means action, acting. It's an activity, this bare awareness, this bare attention. It's an activity. And of course, it's an activity that goes way beyond the cushion, way beyond the cushion. We chant. A lot of people talk about this. You know, we've cut out almost all our chanting on a Sunday, but we still, at the end, chant. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. That vow, that bodhisattva vow. So there, here we are, caught. From the branch, and we're vowing to free all beings. And that's engaged Buddhism. We're vowing to engage in the world, engage in life, to engage in being available, even in the middle of this suffering, even in the middle of this not knowing what to do, even in this middle of this confusion. We're vowing that over and over again, moment after moment again. So there's a lot of talk these days at Zen Center. There used to be, and then there wasn't for years, but again, about engaged Buddhism. Seems like we've got some people here. Well, we've got some good things going. Some good things going. Not just talk, but good things going here in this Sangha that involves specifically engaged Buddhism. Social action, which is based on commitment. As Zazen is based on commitment. And what's the definition of commitment? Here's a definition. An engagement that restricts one's choices. Well, that guy in the tree, his choices were restricted, don't you think? Commitment. An engagement that restricts one's choices. Well, it's not exactly the American way, is it? I mean, isn't freedom to have as many choices as possible? 31 flavors of ice cream, 31 television stations, 31 movies, 31 careers, 31 ways of, I don't know, finding a lover, or making money. 31, 310, 3,100, right? The American way. Freedom of choice. Woo! Look, I don't want to put the freedom of choice down, because if we didn't have freedom of choice, we wouldn't be here this morning. Because not too many of us were raised in this. I certainly wasn't. Nevertheless, commitment. An engagement that restricts one's choices. Interesting, huh? Interesting. So my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, he lived in Japan at the time of the World War. And then afterwards for, let's see, how many years afterwards? 12, 13, 14 years afterwards. So he had the whole time of the war, and then 13 years. So he had about 20 years when he had almost no choices. Almost no choices. And yet he became a great Zen teacher. With almost no choices. He wanted to come to this country to teach Zen when he was a young man. But he couldn't even do anything. Once the war came, that Soto Zen teachers were dissed. They were pushed aside, and so even to be a Soto Zen teacher was. And then he was. They were trying to recruit him to be part of the war effort. He felt like he had no choice, but he didn't want to do it. He hated it, but he had no choice. So he had to maintain his zazen, maintain his composure, maintain his good seat right in the middle of that. He didn't have to, but he did. He did. He maintained his kind, bare awareness. And big difficulty without much choice. And then after the war, they had no food. And Katagiri Roshi talked about that. He was much younger, about how when he was at a Heiji monastery, they had so little food that they went out and gathered weeds and made weed soup for the monks. That was their choice, weed soup, weeds or rocks. And these are our teachers. This is the way our teachers lived. But they had some good times too. And they learned how just to be with what life gave them in stillness, in openness, in joy. But it takes a while. You have to steep yourself in it. You have to commit yourself. And that's restricting your choices. It's restricting your choices. So those of you who sat this morning, restricted your choices. Anytime you sit down, you restrict your choices, especially when you sit here in the Zendo. Because once you come in, everybody else is still. You know, you're not going to make a scene. Well, occasionally someone does. But you're not even going to burp, you know. Occasionally someone does. You're just going to be with it. You're just going to be with what's going on. And that's the beginning of transformation. Just to be with what's going on. With no comment. With no comment. So once we take our seat, once we take our Zen seat, our seat, we don't move ourselves. Don't move until the bell rings. We commit to being with whatever comes up. Whatever comes up. Whatever bad stuff, whatever worries, whatever fears. Just to be, just to breathe. Just to breathe. Just to open and breathe. Open and breathe. Redundant, redundant, boring, redundant. Wonderful. Wonderful. Transformative. You don't feel that way often, I know. But it happens. It happens. Just to me, I'm nobody in particular. And of course, we don't sit here, we sit at home. And sitting at home is good too. But with it at home, it's much easier not to restrict our choices. Oh, I sat for 8 minutes already and and I forgot to take care of, I didn't make my bed. I at least got to get up and make my bed. And then you get up and make your bed and you think, oh, I forgot to do this and that, you're gone. So if you sit at home, it's wonderful practice, but it's harder because you don't have the encouragement of other people. That's why we always sat together. That's why in my whole life I always sat with at least one person. Just one person. One person is good enough. But if you have to sit at home, that's fine. Sit at home. If you can restrict your choices at home, just be with whatever comes up. You can do it anywhere. You can do it anywhere. So what's our practice? When, like the person up the tree, our choices have been restricted. And when at the same time we honor our vow to free all sentient beings, to free all beings, to support everybody, to alleviate everyone's suffering. What we call the impossible vow. Totally impossible. On the one hand, if we save our own life by holding onto the branch from my mouth and not letting it go, I forsake the other. I forsake other people in need. On the other hand, if I open my mouth to save the people in need, what happens to me? This is a dilemma, human dilemma. So we say engage Buddhism, but what's engage Buddhism? It's hard. It's hard. So many of you know that I have a job that entails working with legislators to get support for people with serious or persistent mental illness. That's part of what I do in my job. And you know, I go. This is the time of year that I go down there, and I'm vigorous, and I'm you know, knocking on people's doors, and making appointments, and telling them all good things about, especially with all these things that have been happening nationwide, about how people who have incipient signs of mental illness can be helped early, how they can get support early, before these tragedies occur. So I'm into doing that. But I always have to, when I'm there, other people are there too. There are people there wanting more hospital beds for kids with polio. There are people there wanting more money for people with HIV. There's a whole bunch of us. Well, what do I do? What do I do? Beings are numberless. I got to free them. And we're all there, and a whole bunch of us. The poor legislator. What's the poor legislator do? He's stuck in a tree, isn't he? He doesn't even want to come down and see us, right? So we have, I have a self-protective need, and that is, I protect my family that suffered from great mental illness and still does by doing this. I protect the ghost of my mother by doing this. It helps me. It helps me. But it's self-protective. It's self-protective. Is it bad? No, it's cool. It's wonderful. But I'm risking neglecting the needs of all these other people if I'm not careful, right? If I just go for my own thing. I think I'm the great bodhisattva. If you think you're the great bodhisattva, then you should sit facing a wall for a minute. just breathe. Just breathe. The moment you think you are, you're narrowly focusing on your thing. A poor legislator is going to run away. Doesn't want to talk to any of you. Everybody's grabbing. AIDS, mental illness, developmental disabilities, cancer. They run to the bathroom. Pretty soon, in about a month, they'll all be running to the bathroom because they're trying to make fast legislation and we're all swarming around them at the Capitol. They have less and less time for us. Then we try to catch them between when they're in their office and they're going to the bathroom. I'm not kidding, you guys. I'm not kidding. Exactly how it is. They have to walk between the state office building and the Senate. It's through a tunnel. How many of us try to catch them in the tunnel? How many of us? Who can be a better job of catching? Are we bodhisattvas? Or are we fools? Well, we are bodhisattvas. We are. We're all trying to help people. I'm not talking about certain groups who are just out for themselves. But I mean, you know, they have a really good cause. But even in that situation, we need to be careful because we get attached to our own way of doing it, our own group. We need to engage. Our choices are limited. We can't do everything. I can't help the environment. Oh, I'm helping people with mental illness and people with developmental disabilities. I can't do all those things. I have to engage in this thing, whatever this thing is. But I should do it with an open mind, a still mind, and an open heart. And when I notice that I'm closing down, and I need to really breathe. Really breathe. That's all I need to do. Just breathe. Come back to zero. Come back to zero. My own zero-y nature. Do you know about your zero nature? That's where your peace is. That's where your composure is, in your zero nature. Not minus one, zero. Minus one is I'm bad. You ain't bad. Just nice zero. Nice whole zero. Big zero, right? Whole universe in your zero. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. I vow to free them. Possible or impossible? Engage, we engage, we engage, we engage. So, and if we get too mixed up, then we look at the precepts in Buddhism. We talk about the three pure precepts. The first precept is not to create evil. For my first two years of doing Zen practice, mostly I just focused on not to create evil. Mostly I just focused on that. Meaning, not to get drunk on the weekends. Meaning, not to stay up until 2 a.m. Meaning, what else did I do? Not when I started wanting to get in angry conversations with people, just going and sitting by myself. For my first 2 years, that's all I did so I could establish a good seat. Not create evil. You think about all the ways we create evil. Just not create it. I didn't think about anything else. Just not creating evil. Whatever that means. You know, don't get too philosophical about it. If you start parsing out what's evil, then I'm not talking about that. Just not creating bad vibes. You know how you do it. You know how one thing you do leads to another thing, leads to another thing, leads to another thing. And you can always stop it. You can always stop it. If you have your commitment. With your commitment. Restricting your choices. Restricting your choices. Then after a couple years, I got a pretty good seat. Pretty good seat, not a great seat. Do you know what getting a good seat in Zen means? Well, if you don't know, that's okay. You'll figure it out. You won't figure it out. You'll find it out. You'll find it out. Well, after a couple years, I had an okay seat. Not a really... But an okay seat so I could move on to the other precepts. I could move on trying to do good and trying to help all beings. But the first 2 years, I didn't do that because that would have gotten me all confused, all mixed up, all to-ing and fro-ing and wandering around and despairing. So don't try to do too much at once, please. You can just refrain for one moment from hurting yourself or someone else. That's great. You don't have to worry about doing good. You don't have to worry about freeing any being. Just for one moment, just for one mini second, refrain from doing anything hurtful. See what it's like. See what it's like when that mind all of a sudden just stops. incessant complaining. Just for a moment, it stops that incessant complaining. See what it's like. See what it's like. But then we're ready to do, after we do that for a while, we're ready to do good. We're ready to free all beings. But if we get all mixed up about it, then we just have to come back to something much simpler than that. Even. We're learning, little, by healing others to heal ourselves, by healing ourselves to heal others. So supposedly when the historical Buddha has his awakening, he said, I and all beings attain the way. I and all beings attain the way. He said, I attain the way, and then I'll help all beings attain the way later on if they behave. Or, you know, they've attained the way, and maybe I can do it. You know, I and all beings attain the way. No, no. That's what he said. No. So I've told the story before about... I've told this story in a few years. But I used to tell it all the time. This is a story about when I lived in northern Minnesota. And years ago with my young family. And my wife especially liked wild strawberries. And I don't know. You know, wild strawberries are really tiny. And they take a lot of work to pick them. How many of you have picked wild strawberries? Oh. A lot of you have been in Rome, Minnesota, I see. Rome, Minnesota is something else. It's wonderful. So, you know, you pick wild strawberries. They're just so tiny. My wife loved them. My wife loved them. She was a San Francisco girl. She'd never seen a wild strawberry before. She hated the Iron Range, but she loved wild strawberries. No offense, you guys, for those of you who are rangers, but not strangers. That's what happened when we went up to the Iron Range. We saw a sign. Well, I won't go into that. It was hard to fit in up there, hard to be accepted, if you hadn't been there for 32 generations. So what am I talking about? Oh, yes, berries. So my wife loved wild berries. So one morning I went out and I thought, and I went out early after milking the goats. This is another century, right? this is a counterculture century, which John remembers, don't you, John? Some of us remember that counterculture century. Maybe it was a lot of centuries ago, but it just was yesterday. Anyway, in that counterculture century, after milking the goats, I thought, oh, there's sun on the lawn, on the grass. I bet the berries look good. I'll go pick berries for Linda. She's been up with these children who are... don't behave. I won't get into that. And so I went out and picked berries. It's a lot of work to pick a little bit of wild berries. It's not like picking blueberries or raspberries or strawberries. You have to be very, to have good zazen attention to get them, you know. And so I picked, I don't know how much, maybe this much berries. And maybe it took me... 20 minutes to get this much berries, or half hour, I don't remember. And I brought them home for breakfast and showed them to Linda. And she said, oh, thank you. And then she divided them up, and there was me and her and Jed, and I don't know about my daughter. I don't remember her. She must have been there too. So I guess that's four. I don't know. I don't remember that part. Maybe she was too young to have berries. Anyway, so she divided them up. We each had a little. And you know, I got them for her, but she divided them in four. Well, I thought, well, that's a mama for you, you know, divide them in four. So then Jed, my son, and let's see, what year, how old would he have been? Something like five. So he scarfs his down. And then he scarfs Linda's down. And, you know, about like this. Because it doesn't take long to eat wild berries. And I just notice this. And Linda looks really pleased. And I said, Linda, you didn't have any berries. And she said, no, but they tasted so good. Well, that's a mother and a child, right? It's a mother and a child. But they tasted so good. But they toasted so good. Healing others, we heal ourselves. Supporting others, we support ourselves. And, of course, mother and child, we think that's a restrictive situation. But that's a potential for our lives to do that. To feel supported when we really give. When we really give, we do feel supported. When we give without wondering if we're going to get anything back, we always feel supported if we really give from our heart, not just because we're trying to be a good Buddhist or a good Christian. Forget that. Forget that. That's not what this is about. It's not about that. Not about that. It's committing to being engaged. Engaged. And of course, when you're crying, when you're really suffering, how do I know that I'm hearing your cry? How do I know I'm not just hearing an echo of my own needs or my own needs to support you or to feel good that I can listen to you? How do I know? How do I know that I'm just not caught by my own conditioning? Well, I don't know. I don't know. But that's a chance for bare awareness right there. There's a chance for bare awareness. Always a chance for bare awareness. Always a chance. Always a chance. To really see someone. Just to see someone. Not through your filter. Not through your filter. But just see. Then you won't have any problem sharing berries with them. And they'll taste good, even though you don't get it in yourself. They'll taste wonderful. You'll be nourished by no berries. By an empty plate, no berries will be your great nourishment. Zero. Zero. That's your nourishment. That's where you get your nourishment. Wonderful. Wonderful. Tasty. Tasty. I and all beings attain the way. I and all beings attain the way. Wow. Wow. So engaged Buddhism is completely redundant, isn't it? Isn't it redundant? Dogen says, in life, totally immersed in life without attachment. In death, totally immersed in death without attachment. Okay, now let's move on to Woman's commentary. Okay, it's commentary. Even though your eloquence flows like a river, it is all to no avail. Even if you can expound the great Tripitaka, it is also of no use. The Tripitaka, those are the three primary canons of teaching in Buddhism. It is also of no use. If you can really answer it, you will revive the dead and kill the living. If, however, you are unable to answer, wait for Maitreya to come and ask him. If you can really answer it, you will revive the dead and kill the living. So by committing, by engaging to life, by joining with life, we revive the dead. We revive the dead. People who are dead, people who have given up, people who feel hopeless, people who... We revive them. We revive them. We breathe with them. We help them find their breath. They've lost their breath. They've lost their aspiration, their inspiration, their respiration. They're all connected. You have to respirate, to aspirate, to inspire. But we know how to do this. We know how to breathe. We don't know how to do anything else except breathe. But out of that, wonder, wonderful wonder, wonderful wonder, aspire, inspire. And if we've forgotten how to do it, we just come back to breathing. Respire, so we can do the other. Simple, but it takes practice. It takes engagement. It takes limiting your choices. If you can really answer it, you will revive the dead and kill the living. But if, however, you aren't able to answer, wait for Maitreya to come. Well, Maitreya, as I was saying last time, is the Buddha of loving kindness who comes in the future. Who comes in the future. So we wait. A lot of Zazen is just waiting on our cushion, waiting with loving kindness, waiting for us to sort of our zazen to cook, waiting to cook, just waiting to cook over hopefully a fire that's not too hot. Sometimes it gets hot. I know that, but then it simmers down, waiting to cook. So with loving kindness, we have to do this practice with loving kindness, or we give up, and then what we attain isn't something that all beings attain, and then it's no good. Then it's not Zen. It's not zero. It's some new sort of stiff, uptight religion, or some old stiff, uptight religion, right? So we wait with loving kindness, and we don't know how long it will take. We just do it. We just sit. We just walk. We just live. We just breathe. And the poem by woman. Shanyan is just gibbering. Shanyan is just gibbering. How vicious his poison is. Stopping up the monks' mouths, he makes their devil's eyes glare. Well, this is sort of typical if you know these stories. This is typical. So, there's only one way through. There's only one way through. That's with your bare awareness. That's with your bare attention. And the teacher's redundancy feels like gibbering a lot of the time. It feels like gibbering. The same thing over and over. Just gibbering. I can say that. Why do I have to come all the way to Zen Center when it's cold Sunday morning? I know that. I read that. And sometimes the teacher's teaching feels like poison. Because you feel like it's poisonous for you to sit facing a wall when you have all these worries coming up and there's nowhere for them to go. But you know, they do leave. They don't stick around forever. If you steep, if you cook, they leave. Oh, I come back. But they leave. So once you know that they leave, when they come back, you're kind of happy to see them. But not, you don't get too happy. Just say, hi, here you are again. You don't give them beds. You just invite them into the front room. Don't take off their coats. Don't offer them a coat rack. Be very gentle with them in the front room, you know. As long as they don't sit down. you learn how to do this. You learn how to do this. Or you don't learn. There's a learning that takes place of doing this. It isn't you. Or it is you. I don't care. It's confusing to figure it out. Whether it's who does it, right? Who's doing it? Don't need to figure it out. Forget that. So this teacher, Shanyan, reminds me of another story, which is one of the first stories Zen stories I read, which you guys know who've read Paul Reps's. This is the first book I read on Zen was a book by Paul Reps, and I think there were 100 stories. And this story about the guy hanging from the tree reminds me of this story. A man, and those of you who've read Zen know this story already. A man traveling across a field encountered a tiger. He fled, the tiger after him. Coming to a precipice, he caught hold of the root of a wild vine and swung himself down over the edge. The tiger sniffed at him from above. Trembling, the man looked down to where, far below, another tiger was waiting to eat him. Two mice, one white and one black, little by little began to gnaw away the vine. The man saw a luscious strawberry near him. Oh, he got strawberries again. The man saw a luscious strawberry near him. Grasping the vine with one hand, he plucked the strawberry with the other. How sweet it tasted. How sweet it tasted. So, is that a solution to the first problem? It sounds like a solution. The problem with the first one is that there isn't any strawberry there. There's no strawberry there. It's just a dead branch and a yucky leaf. So this is a great story. This is a very inspirational story. It kept me going for at least 3 years until I've realized there was no strawberry. Sometimes there's a strawberry, but sometimes there's none. Sometimes there isn't any. You bring yourself back to the moment. You're finally focused. You're finally open. Who wants that? Who wants that? You've got a dead beetle, not a strawberry. So this is a great story about being in the here and now. But Shanyan, a little more of a realist, he said, it ain't always the case. It ain't always the case. Well, that's okay. Nothing's always the case. In bare awareness, we don't need anything to be always the case. We don't need everything to be always the case. How could it be? How could it be? So my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, I haven't told this story for 4 to 6 years, 3 to 5 years, 2 to 4 years. when he was dying, and you can read this in the book of in Crooked Cucumber. So when he was dying, one of his students, who I knew quite well, his senior student, he was dying of cancer. He had cancer. And he got very yellow with that cancer. And he was only about, he was less than 5 feet, but when he got cancer, he really shriveled up. He really shriveled up. Of course, I wasn't there, but that's another story. So my friend went to visit him just not very long before he died. At the very end, when he couldn't talk anymore, and his wife was feeding him, and other people were feeding him. He couldn't talk anymore. And he was under the covers. When you're sick, going under the covers is pretty good. Pretty good. So he was under the covers, but then my friend came, and he pulled the covers back and was glad to see my friend, because he was his treasured student, his precious student. Student-teacher relationship is kind of precious. He felt so glad to see his student. So glad to see him. Because passing on this bare awareness is what we're all about. We pass it on. We pass it on. So he was so happy to see him. So happy to see him. And but he couldn't talk. And he was very weak. And my friend said to him, when will we see you again? My friend knew he was just about ready to die. When will you see you again? But of course, Suzuki couldn't talk, right? Suzuki went like this. He pulled his hands out under the covers, his yellow hands, his little yellow hands. And he went like this. And then he went like this. And then he went like this. This. Everything's included. Nobody's left out. Life, death, strawberries, yucky things. Everything's included. Everything's included. Everything. Everything. You can discover this for yourself. This is for you to discover. This is for you to pass on. It needs to be passed on. It needs to be passed on. People are all mixed up. You can pass it on. You're passing it on in just your practice. Just your practice. Engaging. I'm engaging. I and all beings attain the way. I and all beings attain the way. Okay, that's what I want to talk about today. Questions, comments?
Just two things to say, I guess.
Sure.
So the first story didn't have a strawberry, but it did have another being whose needs were very great.
Uh-huh. That's right. Good point. Do you want to elaborate on that? Or you just want to make that point?
Well, the second thing. Maybe this is an elaboration. Maybe not. There's a book that I'm currently reading called The World Until Yesterday by Jared Diamond, which is really fascinating, I find, anyway. It's an account of traditional societies. And as he points out, for about 100,000 years, human beings, like us, basically, have been around. And for most of that time, we've been hunter-gatherers and developed all these different ways of forming social groups and raising children and dealing with problems of aging and all kinds of other questions like that. Thousands, tens of thousands of different sorts of organizations. And then about 10,000 years ago, people kind of discovered planting stuff in the ground and farming. That was a big transformation. But these are still very traditional societies. Mm-hmm. And then finally, about 6,000 years ago, the first states started to appear, the first governments. This book, anyway, is an account of all kinds. So he says, okay, so we have all of this experience, this wealth of experience of organizing ourselves. Mm-hmm. And what can this teach us today about the big questions that we confront? Well, we can find out something about that deep past by looking at some of the current traditional societies in New Guinea, in Africa, and elsewhere. And one of the things he looks at in one of his chapters is the dangers that people confront in traditional societies. And one of the main causes of death in traditional societies is falling out of trees. Or having a tree fall on you.
Interesting. Very good. Very good. Thank you. All right, thank you. Anything else? Any other questions or comments or anything? Yeah, hi.
I was a little surprised about your endorsement of the sentence that says, if you can really answer it, you will receive the dead. No, you will revive the dead and kill the living. It's just probably me being a little unaware of.
Oh, yeah, well, okay, so where is that one? If you can really answer it, you will revive the dead. Well, I did explain that first part, right?
Yes. Kill the living.
Well, kill the living. Well, you know, if we didn't cling to living, if we didn't cling to being someone, to being something, to the next moment, we'd live with a lot more peace. So killing the living, I take as being killing this clinging to grasping, to holding on to only breathing in. We have to breathe out to breathe in. We have to die to live. The more we learn to breathe out, the more the breath just comes into the whole body, circulates everywhere. That's what I take it to mean. That's what I take it to mean.
Or is it reviving the living? Is that actually the dead? Is that really what we hope for?
And again, but I'm not taking this. I'm saying that we do. Yes. People. This is. I'm just being redundant. People go through their lives dead, stuffed up with ideas and booze and television and worries and concerns. We want to revive them. We want to revive them so they can appreciate just one little strawberry. That's all they need to. That's all we need to give them. One little strawberry. Definitely.